Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Hej, välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med häst. Jag heter Maria Willemsson. I de kommande avsnitten ska vi få stifta bekantskap med Tamsin Furtado och Rebecca Smith från University of Liverpool. De är båda forskare inom ämnet kommunikation och compliance inom veterinärmedicin. I det första avsnittet talar jag med Tamsin Furtado om vad compliance egentligen är i de här sammanhangen och om hur kunskapen om mänskligt beteende kan hjälpa veterinärer att bli bättre på kommunikation. Welcome to the podcast, Tamsin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, can you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your background, and what you are doing at the moment?
Yes, sure. So, I'm a social scientist by background. It's something that I've come into kind of accidentally. My background's psychology and linguistics at uni, and then I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I kind of fell into a career in human health, which was so interesting. I was looking at how we can improve clinical research in low and middle income countries, but it was all about how we can build capacity and get communities to work together and so on, and I learned a huge amount there and loved it, but my real passion, I guess, lies in animal health and well-being and those interconnections between humans and animals. So I took a sort of side step to work in social science of human-animal interactions at University of Liverpool. And it's kind of found my niche, I guess. I absolutely love it now. And I work on lots of different projects about equine welfare, but from the perspective of how can we work better with people to kind of make sure that animals are as healthy as they can be and as well as they can be, really.
Yeah. That's a very interesting background, and it's, I guess, the step from human health to animal health isn't that far, and after all, we also work a lot with humans, even though we're in veterinary medicine.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's so overlooked that veterinary medicine is really about working with humans.
Yeah.
And lots of, I know vet students always say about halfway through, oh, I didn't realize I was going to know so much about humans. So in terms of teaching people about the science of human behavior change, which is kind of my bread and butter, really, the main thing we often say is that actually in almost every single case, if you want to change the horse, in this case, the horse well-being, then you have to get a person to change first. So really knowing about the human behavior change is almost more important than the horse stuff.
Yeah.
And yet it's kind of a second, a second thing, or learning about communications is like a secondary thing in comparison to animal health. Obviously you need both, absolutely. I'm really passionate about how important that is in terms of vet communication, really.
Yeah, yeah, I can tell. So are you a horsey person yourself? Do you have horses or?
Yes, I am. I've grown up with horses and done all of the different horse sports at some point or other. I used to show jump a lot, not very well. Now I do endurance riding, which I absolutely love. So I've got a mad Arab who I compete called Merlin. Then also we've got some other horses hanging out in the field, including a really super cute little rescue pony who looks like a Yeti at this time of year. So yes, lots of time with the horses as well.
Oh,
so I know
wonderful.
What it's like to be an owner on the other side of the vet communication.
Yeah, of course.
Well.
I mean, that perspective is also really important.
Sure. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
We're going to be talking about owner compliance and management compliance. And I wanted to start by asking you, what do we actually mean when we talk about compliance in veterinary medicine?
Yeah, well, that's such a good question. So generally, I get this a lot where vets say, how can we work with people to make sure that they comply better with our recommendations. And it always makes me cringe a little bit, I have to say, because What we mean when we say compliance is that we want people to do the thing. We want them to follow our instructions. And generally, when people talk about compliance, they say it with a sense of frustration, like, oh, it's so hard that, you know, we've got obese horses or horses with equine asthma or ulcers or aging or whatever, and we need them to do the thing, whatever the thing is, and we just can't get them to do it. So how can we get them to comply? And it's quite an interesting concept, that, because it kind of, what that suggests is that we know best, and that they are in the role of being a kind of receiver of information, and that they should receive and act on information. And that's actually a very problematic concept in a lot of ways, because we know that actually human behaviour change is quite tough. And all of us, I'm sure, have tried to change our behaviour multiple times before, whether that's, I don't know, deciding to exercise more or trying to be more organised at work or making time to exercise our own horses or dogs or, I don't know, have a better work-life balance, all of those things and more. And we know that when we try and put changes in place, actually, there are many things that we need to do to adjust our plans and our lifestyle if we're going to be successful with change. So the idea of compliance kind of automatically suggests that the person's kind of doing something wrong by not following us. And the other thing is that it suggests that it's a kind of, the client is quite passive in that role of information receiving, so that we're kind of telling them what to do and they should just take it on board. So we kind of often ideally move on, really, and take inspiration from the human world, where they've kind of moved on to talking about compliance moved on to talking about concordance rather than talking about compliance. And that's a slightly different concept, which suggests that both of the both parties, the clients and the professional, have a role to play in their expertise on the change that's going to be made. And then they can kind of work together to bring about that change, rather than it being a case of the vet telling the person what to do and the person following or not following.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, It doesn't work if we don't work together, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So you mentioned then human medicine. What else can we learn from human medicine about this idea of compliance or concordance, as you call it?
Yeah, so there's been loads of research in human medicine, which is great, because it means we can rely on, we can fall back on that. And obviously, in lots of ways, horses in particular are quite different from human medicine, so we'd expect the consults to be different. You know, obviously horses have a monetary value. Some people would see them as a you know, component in, like, a, you know, almost like sporting piece of equipment. Some people would see them as like their best friend. You know, horses fulfill lots of different roles, but nevertheless, there's still a lot we can learn from the human medicine world. And in that, there are lots of studies about what makes a successful consult in human medicine, which we can learn from. And those really suggest that the most important thing is that people feel like they're being kind of listened to and respected, and that they're most likely to want to follow through with the suggestions of a medical person. If they feel that they've had like a two-way discussion where they've been respected, their views and opinions have been taken into account, and the plan has been kind of adjusted accordingly. So that's why in human medicine, we would talk about things like shared decision making, where you have that idea of kind of equal partners coming together. So the doctor or the medical, the nurse has obviously medical expertise, which the person might need to learn, but the person has expertise on their own capacity, on what changes are going to make sense and be possible in their own life. So what you want is a partnership there, where both those expertises are equally valid, so that we can kind of work together and share those. So it's quite different. I know that, you know, we hear all the time, if you think back to different doctor's appointments, a friend of mine recently came back from the doctors and they said his cholesterol was high, and they just said, do X, Y, Z, you know, cut out, you know, I don't know, cut out cheese, do this. And he was like, well, I don't eat cheese. The other one didn't make sense, blah, blah. But that was all the advice that was given. So it put him on a back foot. Whereas, like, if we think back to other consults, I'm sure we've all had consults that have been quite good and where we felt kind of listened to, or like, our views have been taken into account. They tend to be the ones that are more successful, and that you remember, you build trust with the person as well.
Mm. Isn't that something that is being discussed also, that the better you sort of, as a patient, the more you feel sort of listened to, the more successful you will also be in your rehabilitation or whatever it is you're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. It's so interesting. There are some really interesting psychological theories around that, around any sort of behaviour change. And, you know, usually rehabilitation involves behaviour change, doesn't it? Whether it's physiotherapy or whether it's taking a medication or a lifestyle change. And that so there are some really interesting psychological theories which, you know, really all come back to this idea that what we need is to feel empowered, to feel that we've got a choice in what we're doing and a choice to participate or not in that change, and that we're making active choices for ourselves, and that we have a support team around us who are making us feel like they're on our side. And those are kind of really powerful theories. I think they're really important to think about and respect it. You know, we all have lots of experience with our own change, you know, trying to change ourselves and trying to change other people. You know, maybe it's trying to make your husband do the washing up or make your kids do their homework, whatever it is. But actually, it tends to be that when people feel positive about the change and feel supported, that that's when things are likely to kind of follow through.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that is that makes a lot of sense also when translated to the veterinary world.
Exactly.
I guess especially when you, or maybe always, but I'm thinking especially of the owners who do consider their pets or their horses or dogs or cats or whatever as family members, then it will be even more.
Yes.
So when we're translating this then to the veterinary world and to our daily life, sort of as veterinary professionals, do you have any good practical examples of how the vet approach, how they can change the outcome or the success in the therapy and rehabilitation?
Yeah, absolutely. The main thing which I always say to vets alongside this is to use questions to just ask the client what they want and what's important to them, because vets often say to me, yeah, but not every client wants to be listened to, and you know that some people do want specific guidelines, and that's, of course, we're all different, you know, that's what makes the world go round. So I suggest as much as possible using open questions to ask the client where they are. They can tell you, you know, if they're ready to change or not and what they need, but also how they want the information relayed to them. And I've got a lovely example of that from a vet in the UK who was working with, this is in relation to equine obesity, and she had a client who she just didn't click with at all. She didn't feel like she particularly wanted to spend time with this client, and the client had overweight horses, and she'd been going out and doing vaccine visits annually for years and had been saying, your horses, they're really overweight, you know, it's really dangerous, we need to do something about this, and had never felt like there was any kind of connection there or like she was being listened to and that there was no behavior change there. And one year she had been to some of the talks that we've had in the UK about this stuff. And she was then there on a sedate to clip visit. So she had a little while where she was standing around doing nothing. And she thought, well, I've got nothing to lose here. I might as well just try something different. So she said, so instead of telling the person that the horses were overweight and they needed to change the behavior around the horses, she started asking questions about kind of what about the horses, about the what was important to the owner, and asking the owner what the owner thought of the horse's weight. Did she think they were overweight herself, and at what point did she think she might make a change? And she said, it's really interesting, she said that the whole demeanor of the whole conversation changed. And by the end, she really liked the woman and they were having a great chat. And the woman was really involved in talking about the change that they might make. And so this vet said to her by the end, she said, we've known each other for years and we've never been able to talk like this. You know, what is it that's different this time? And the woman said, you were different this time. And I think that was such an interesting example. Obviously, everyone is different and every vet is going to have their own way of communicating. And, you know, that's absolutely fine. But I think it's that what what's really interesting to me about that example is just when you have the mental capacity and the space in your day, just trying something different and seeing if it works for you it's a great example of having been able to do that. And then, you know, she's now able to use those approaches in with her other clients when she's finding things tough. So I love that story. I think it's such a useful story of how we can all just sometimes try things differently rather than kind of getting stuck in our own habits. But also using the listening, asking questions rather than telling can make a big difference to the clients.
Mm. So did the horses actually lose weight then?
Yes. So she's got a much better response, much better relationship with this woman over now. And so that's actually led not only to the horses kind of losing weight, but also to them, you know, trusting the vet practice more because they've got this kind of better ongoing relationship and they see her as an ally. So I think I think Becky will talk later a lot about the, you know, the importance of, you know, in every consult, how much actually that has a wider benefit as well, because it's all about, you know, how we who we trust for information. And if we trust the vet in front of us, we're going to go to them when we have queries rather than, you know, just a big accident or a vaccination. Mm. So, it has a wider, there's a wider benefits as well there, I think.
I'm thinking also that maybe, I mean, it sounds really easy, you know, ask a lot of questions, listen. But yeah. I think it's probably, you know, when you have to realize that I need to find a different approach, or that you have to sort of take this step mentally yourself.
Yes.
And be willing to try it. I mean, that sounds like that's the main key here.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, there are more principles than I'm kind of outlining the really basic kind of tenets to the human behavior change, which is to respect other people and communicate with them in a position of respect. But of course, there is kind of more to it. And, you know, just asking questions. You're absolutely right. You need to know a little bit more in there as well, because you need to also be able to kind of help to direct the conversation when they answer the questions by telling you a 2-hour story about, you know, their first pony or something, which happens a lot, I know. But you're right. I think there's that. So there is kind of more to it, and we can absolutely share some resources alongside the podcast if that's helpful for people. But also that it's that kind of mindset shift of thinking. So if we start off from a position where we're like, how can we make people do the things we want them to do? It's a mindset shift to how can we work with people so that we get an outcome for their horse that works for both of us, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, as I said, that's probably the key thing, just to sort of think that through yourself and be willing to also change your own, maybe, way of asking questions or...
Yeah, for sure. Can I just ask Maria? I know, of course, you're a vet nurse, and here in the UK, there's a real move to have vet nurses doing more of the conversations that need this type of approach, because vet nurses tend to be in a position where often very good communicators, and people tend to trust them a lot. So for things like obesity consults or equine asthma, for example, being ideally placed to do that. Is there a move in the Nordic countries to do the same?
I think so, definitely in the small animal veterinary medicine.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And that's also something that we learn at university, right? To talk to owners, discuss with owners, listen to owners and so on. But I would say, especially in the veterinary, in the small animal veterinary settings, that then the nurse's job is really important in this regard. So absolutely. And it's also, I mean, as a nurse, you tend to hang out a little bit more with the owners, right? Then because the vet is busy with the animal or busy doing other consultations. So you tend to sort of spend a little bit more time with them, I guess. But it's something I think that could be utilized better. I mean, we can always be better at what we do. But I know that at least some clinics and in some settings that they're really using this resource that nurses actually are.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting that you mention it, that people tend to work that way in the UK, because I think we're moving towards it if we're not already there, sort of.
I mean, it's quite recent that there's been this change. I think vet nurses are often really overlooked with these sorts of things. And it's interesting, small animal here as well has been much quicker to pick up on nurses as a potential resource for some of those more tricky conversations. It's interesting equine is behind in both places, but it's good that change is hopefully coming.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes owners also tend to be a little bit more relaxed when the vet's not around, because then it's, I mean, maybe a little bit more comfortable to ask difficult questions. And I mean, as a nurse, you often find the situation that you are sort of the translator between the owner and the vet, and that something that the vet have said, maybe the owner is very stressed and they didn't pick up everything, and then the questions come when the vet has left the room, sort of, and then so those conversations are also really important.
That's so interesting, actually, then, in terms of that role, because we know that when people are under stress, we'll talk about this later in the when we talk about the difficult conversations around, you know, maybe a poor prognosis or euthanasia, that people can't take it, your brain physically can't take in that level of information. So it's really interesting to think of the nurse there being the kind of translator. And if you don't have a nurse there, then who is, you know, someone else is going to be providing that, because the person will need those answers. So, you know, that's often when people are then, you know, going to social media, for example, or asking, you know, their livery yard manager, who may provide fantastic support but may not. So you know, it's, I think that's another feature when we talk about inverted commas compliance, or whether we can work with people to make change. We have to remember who is providing, you know, the vet might provide one voice there, but there are going to be all these other voices. So whatever we can do to make sure that the information coming through is good information, reliable, and evidence-based, whether that's a veterinary nurse or share it or sending them to, you know, other reliable resources, then we're kind of setting them up for success then.
So we're talking about then working together with the owner and setting ourselves up for success. And it's sometimes, I mean, owner compliance or owner, what's the word you used again? Concordance.
I mean, yeah.
Concordance. Owner concordance is always important. But I mean, some conditions do require a little bit more work from the owner. It's always important that they are, that you're on the same sort of track, but some of it requires a little bit more work. We're going to be talking about obesity in the next episode. That's, of course, a given one here. But when we talk about aegis management in specifically, what are your best tips when it comes to talking to owners about aegis and what they need to sort of change or do at home for their horse?
Yeah, I think with any of those sorts of conditions where horses are going to have a long-term management change, so aegis, maybe rehabilitation for kissing spines, maybe equine asthma, obesity, PPID, any of these things, some of the really important things to remember, which people often overlook, is that our social environment and our physical environment makes a massive difference to whether or not we're able to carry through with making a behaviour change. So often the way the yard is set up, for example, or the people on the yard these often sound like really silly barriers, like the hay that you need to soak or steam is like right down the other end of the yard and it's really difficult, or you know, the horse is actually just a bit grumpy about whatever procedure you need to do. Any of these things actually are the things that make or break behavior change often. You know, a good human example would be like we decide in January that we're going to go to the gym and we decide, okay, I'm going to sign up to the gym, and you're all enthusiastic. And then often it's the really silly little physical things, physical environment things, like a traffic jam on the way to the gym, or, you know, it's raining or the hours don't work for you. Those are the things that make it difficult. So what I would say with those longer term changes is to talk to the owner. It's to say to the owner, so you as the vet or the vet nurse can provide the specific expertise, but they are the ones who need to work out whether it works for their life, their lifestyle with their horse, whether the horse is happy with the changes, which is another really important thing, because owners can't, it's really hard for owners to follow through if the change makes the horse look sad, which I'll talk more about with obesity, and also whether it's feasible for the owner. Another example of that is that when we talk about hay soaking or steaming, I mean, it, do you know, this was one of the biggest things that came up in my study. And I was so like, oh my God, what? We're all crazy, aren't we? Because the number of participants in my study who said, oh, well, I did break my back once, so it's a bit difficult for me to carry this hay. And, you know, it's always that I've broken my back on the horse in the past at some point. And now I have a dodgy back, which obviously doesn't, you know, stop people at all. But mm-hmm. things like soaking and steaming hay are really, really difficult for people. Mm-hmm. So even little things like creating a pulley system so that it can help and they don't have to haul things around, haul the hay into the wheelbarrow, can just literally be a massive game changer. Now, as a vet, obviously you can't hang out for hours chatting about how to create a pulley that will help their back, but what you can do is talk to them about what sorts of issues they think they might face, and how they are going to find ways to overcome them, because they can do that themselves, and they'll enjoy the creative process, or they can, you know, that's where social media is great, because there's so many people who have been creative in the past. So I would say, if you've got those long-term compliance things, then talk to the owner about, you know, there will be difficult things. There'll be maybe people on the yard who think they're being mental, or there'll be, you know, times when it's really hard because they're, I don't know, tired, or the, I don't know, yard's muddy, whatever the issue is. So if they can work out in advance how to overcome those, how to be creative, then that's when you can often follow through with really successful change, which lasts over time, I think.
And also, I guess, finding out what is difficult for that particular owner, because it will be different from person to person. It's so easy to just read in a textbook, you should do this and that. But then to actually manage or follow through, that's a whole different story.
Of course, and you mentioned before about the questions, the the role of the nurse translating there. But I think that's the thing, you know, we've all been there where you read a textbook and it says, okay, you need to do X, Y, Z. And you're like, oh, okay. But then when you go to do it, then, you know, X, you have three questions about how to do X, and then Y is quite easy. But Z is like, oh my God, actually, that's not going to work for me. There's no way. So of course, we have to have tailored plans. It's really important. And in this case, we've got to tailor them both to the horse and the owner, because they have to be feasible in the real world. So, yeah, I totally agree.
So, I mean, you've done a lot of research in this area. And we all know that research is a lot about measuring and evaluating. So when it comes to this sort of large topic of owner compliance and how to talk to owners, how do we evaluate, or how do we measure if our strategy has been successful, for example, or how do you measure in or evaluate in research, for example, if what's working and what's not working, sort of?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it kind of depends what level of change you're looking for. So it's really hard to measure change, like real world change for the animals. So let's say we want to measure equine ulcers prevalence on a yard. Measure it, or, you know, am I making a difference to obesity prevalence across the whole of the northwest of England or whatever? It's really hard because you've got obviously so many confounding variables. And, you know, yes, you could go out and measure all the horses. You could go out and, you know, scope all the horses and look for their ulcers, but it's also often expensive and very difficult to do that. But that would be the ideal, would be that, you know, I or you puts in place an intervention and you go out and you see if all the behaviour change has fallen into place and there's a real difference in the horses. But that's not always what you... So you can do that in some ways, but there's also other things that we can do as a kind of interim step. So one of them would be, in this case, talking, asking vets about how confident they are having those conversations with people. Mm. And do they think that they're making any sort of difference, having had more training, for example, in communication? Of course, that's not foolproof, because vets might think they're having they're making a difference to people, but actually we don't know about the owners. So maybe we would also question the owners about whether they feel more confident now in putting in place changes. Which would be another way, so we could survey owners or interview owners after veterinary visits and then maybe follow up with them and see if they're putting in place changes. So I think there's a range of things that we can do, and it depends if the outcome that you want is around the real life change to the horse, which may of course take a long time to happen, but is the ideal, or whether you can use interim measures of owner behaviour change, for example, or vet self-reported confidence. So yeah, it's a tricky one, but there's kind of multiple ways that we can go about doing it. I would say, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of. As you say, there's so many confounding variables, so it's probably impossible to tell if just one intervention was the one thing that did the trick, or the 100%, because there are so many things that have to fall into place. But I guess then the best evaluation is just how you sort of see that things are going long term.
Yeah, I think ideally we'd usually use like a range of different things. So with equine obesity, for example, we are monitoring the condition of, we've got one major show where we monitor the exact same classes every year to see if we're getting trends where the horses are getting slimmer. And then we also monitor across different shows and then kind of put that data together. So we've got some prevalence data, but it's still only ever going to be a limited. It's so hard to measure these things on a population level. You know, that's only horses that go to shows. So, you know, what about the ones on, you know, on yards? Some vet practices will just take a body condition score as standard, but it's quite variable whether they do that. So we have some prevalence data, but we would also try and monitor with the vets and with owners to, you know, see if they're making changes. We have kind of other things to look at, changing confidence in body condition scoring, that sort of thing. But it really does depend on the project and being quite specific about what you're looking for. So that's the tough bit. As you say, there's so much going on in the world, it's really hard to see what difference you're making. So.
yeah, of course. So, but when we're talking about then evaluating or assessing how successful you are, or how something is, a new sort of strategy is working, are there any tools, or for owners maybe in specifically, but also for vets maybe, to sort of evaluate if a particular strategy has been working out, or just to evaluate how good owners are at following your advice?
Yeah, there are various apps and things that we can use. So I don't know, there's a really popular one in the UK for recording exercise called Equilab, I think, and another one called Enduro, where people can record their rides and it will say how much they're doing, how much trot, how much canter, and so on. There are various horse health apps. I don't know how popular they are. I don't know what's in the Nordic countries. But to be honest, we found that, you know, a horse owner is going to be just as successful with whatever works for them. So some horse owners, I quite like paper, so I would have like a notebook at the yard and then just jot down the condition score maybe every time the farrier comes, and then you know, also do a weigh tape at that point and have a day that's set, and I know I'll do it because the farrier's there, I've got some extra time, and then it's like an easy reminder to do that every time. And then the vet can also of course check that if they want to. Maybe other people would like, you know, probably maybe write a note on their phone and have like a notes thing. So it kind of depends what's most appropriate for that owner. And I think, again, that's something that the vet and owner could work out themselves. So vet saying to owners what works for you to monitor your change over time. Or photographs is another really good one, because obviously all horse owners love having photographs of their horse, but often don't think about taking like a good square photo without any tack. But they're so useful to look at change over time in musculature, body condition, you know, whether they've got that big belly when they're a bit ulcery or wormy or whatever. So I think photos are really useful there as well. So for owners monitoring changing their own horses, then I think it's whatever suits, but as long as they are monitoring something, mm-hmm. Ideally with photos to back it up. But some people love apps, don't they? I'm not mm-hmm. really an app person, but some people love recording all that stuff.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tamsin, for this talk. We're going to come back in the next episode with and talk a little bit more about obesity. But thank you for now.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcast-app så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen. Och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.